Today, I'm extremely excited to introduce to our listeners Kenny Kushnick, who had held various positions at Sire Records, which we had brought up multiple times on the podcast because Sire was distributed through Warner's and through WEA, and they had some pretty phenomenal bands. Kenny, when you started with them, where were you guys with, you know, the bigger bands in the beginning were the Ramones and the Talking Heads. Can you kind of tell us how those two bands got into the fold with Sire?
The Ramones were there when I arrived. I arrived in fall of 76, if I'm remembering this correctly. The Ramones' first album had already been out. And basically, I had a friend who was the head of promotion at Sire. And at that time, I had just moved back to New York from Los Angeles. I was looking around for something to do, and I bumped into my friend, Lenny Scafidi. He said, oh, you should, you know, come up to the office and we'll have lunch. And so that began a series of meetings over weeks, just hanging out, reconnecting. And he kept telling me that I needed to see the Ramones, that whatever you think of the record, you got to see them live. You know, if you like the record, you'll love them. If you hate the record, you'll like them. Like, it has to be experienced live. And we kept trying to set a time. They played a few gigs. I never made it. And finally, I find myself in a cab on the way to Max's Kansas City. And in I go, and I'm sitting at a table. That is where I met Seymour for the first time. And a couple of other people, I guess, were at the table with me and Lenny. You know, the next thing I know, a band starts playing, and it's clearly not the Ramones. I don't know who it is. And I have a combination of the John Landau, I have seen the future of rock and roll moment, crossed with the John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, I'm falling in love with the girl and everything's in slow motion moment.
Wow.
That band turned out to be Talking Heads.
Oh, wow.
They were not signed to Sire. And I didn't even know that they were on the bill. But it was, you know, really mind-altering for me. So, again, I've only been back in New York for a few weeks. You know, I'm coming in from the soft rock LA scene, and here is this, you know,
that's so great,
punk thing happening that's trying to, you know, reclaim the real rock and roll, you know, what rock and roll meant when it first came on the scene, and, you know, women were clutching their pearls and, you know, men were swearing about it, you know, and
yeah,
kids catch these days, right?
Right,
so,
right.
I don't know what's up. So I'm looking in the Village Voice, and I see that these Talking Heads are playing their own show at a place that, as I read it in the paper, I thought was called Sibjibs, but it turned out that you pronounced it by saying each of the letters, and it was CBGBs.
Got it.
Sibjibs.
Right. I took the subway to 4th Street, and I'm walking down the Bowery, and as I'm walking, I'm going, I'm going to die. I'm absolutely going to die. I should turn back. But I really want to see the band. But I'm going to die. I should turn back. And then I finally got to, you know, far enough down where I said, well, I could just as easily die walking back, so I might as well keep going.
There you go.
You're committed.
Right. So I find this place, and I walk in. I ask the bartender where the men's room is, and he says it's in the back and then downstairs. And in order to get to the back, basically the stage takes up like three-quarters of the end of the venue. It's a long railroad venue. And there's a path on the left side of the stage that leads further into the back and the stairs that go down. And as I'm walking out of the corner of my eye, I see there is a doorway created by the back of the stage and like a freestanding wall. And that's the dressing room, and the talking heads are in it. But like, I catch that out of the corner of my eye as I go. So I keep going. I go down the stairs. I see the infamous graffiti in the bathroom. I take a leak. I come back upstairs. And as I get to where they are, I just poke my head in the door and say, I don't mean to bother you, but I saw the Max's show the other night, and it was incredible. You guys are amazing. And Chris France, in his best, you know, Mater D-ness, oh, thank you so much. Please come in.
He's such a good guy.
So I step into this incredibly tiny room where Tina's sitting on a couch tuning her bass, and David is already at the back wall, and I sense that he is trying to meld into the wall because there's now a stranger in the room. But I keep trying to excuse myself, and Chris says, no, it's fine, it's fine. And I'm chatting with Chris, and at a certain point, I just say, look, let me let you get on with it. I'm really looking forward to seeing the show. Very nice to meet everybody. And Chris says, well, please come back after the show. So I watch them play again. It's even more amazing. I, you know, completely let go of my soft rock roots and become a convert. And so I start going to see them whenever they're playing.
This was before Jerry Harrison, is that correct?
Yes, this is definitely before Jerry.
Wow. So they were a trio at that moment.
It's the original trio. And unbeknownst to me, they had decided to quit playing for about 6 to 9 months and Woodshed in their loft. So they had been playing gigs in town. And certainly unbeknownst to me, Seymour, you know, had seen them. And I just happened to hit town right when the woodshedding was over. And so they booked themselves like a show a week for 2 months. And they played every appropriate venue, you know, Max's, CBGB's, the Ocean Club, and tons of others. And so they were playing at least once a week.
What is the average size of the crowd at these clubs? Let's kind of give us maybe a picture of what we're talking about.
They probably held between 100 and less than 200.
Wow.
And I would say it was pretty full, but not overflowing.
Max's Kansas City was a little larger, wasn't it? Because I remember going there.
200, maybe.
And Seymour Stein, just so the listeners understand, was the president of Sire Records.
Right. He was the head of Sire. He had signed the Ramones. He had run the label when it started out, probably 10 years before this, maybe even a little more. And it had been primarily originally like English blues leading into what were the foundations of prog rock.
They originally had Fleetwood Mac. They had a band called Renaissance.
Right. Those were two of the
Climax Blues Band.
Climax Blues Band.
Couldn't get it right.
Yeah.
In the middle of the night.
That song, that Couldn't Get It Right is what closed the deal with Warner Brothers.
Wow.
Yeah, and I worked that record.
At this point, they are distributed by PolyGram. Or actually, I'm wrong. They were distributed by ABC before it was bought by MCA.
And at that time, ABC had signed Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of who ABC had. They had a few bands.
Well, they had all like pop records, like Hamilton, Joe Frank, and Reynolds. Bo Donaldson and the Haywoods, The Night Chicago Died. They were all like one-off.
I've never heard of any of those.
I know every one of those bands.
I've never heard of any of them.
Hamilton, Joe, Frank, and Reynolds.
Yeah, a lot of them were classic. Top 10 singles, but there was no album, that had any success. They were one-off single successes or two.
I kind of call those the AM pop bands that I grew up as a kid listening to before FM really mm-hmm. blew up. I mean, those were all the songs that was getting played on AM radio.
Absolutely. And so I'm making the point of that is if there was any label that had any hope of understanding what the Ramones and the Talking Heads and Dead Boys, like, this wasn't it.
That
right?
wasn't
it. It was literally, you know.
Wasn't it.
I can't, yeah. It was a bad fit.
to be polite.
But, you know, there we, hey, you know what? People need jobs. So there we were. So anyway.
Knowing that, what was it that you were like, man, this is not where I need to be? But was it just because you needed a job or what was it brought you there?
Well, I'm in New York and I am looking for a job. But at this point, I'm just like gone Talking Heads crazy.
Right.
You know, so I'm just going to shows not believing what I'm seeing, that this thing is so, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm loving every minute of it, and I'm doing that. Now, so the night, you know, the first time I saw Talking Heads, Seymour was right there at the table. The unbeknownst to me, when I went to CBGB's that night, first of all, I didn't know he had any interest in them, and I didn't know he was out of town. So I forged my relationship with Chris, and I started going to all the shows, and Seymour came to a bunch of them. And again, I didn't know this, but behind the scenes, he's like leaning over. You know, I'm going backstage all the time, saying hi to David, saying hi to Tina, talking to Chris, and Seymour's standing there like whispering under his breath to whoever he's with, like, who the fuck is that guy? And why is he, you know, like, I can't talk to Chris. Like, what's going on? So as time goes on and I continue to go visit my friend who runs promotion there and get a lunch or two out of it, obviously I bump into Seymour in the building. It's a three-story brownstone on the Upper West Side.
Oh, I remember that. Big. That's where I met you. So I it was that three-story brownstone. I remember that.
Right. So I bump into Seymour on the stairs one day, and he says, you and I should meet. You know, call my secretary and come take a meeting with me. So I go, okay. Right. You know, so this is my lucky day. Something's going to happen. Right. So we have a series of meetings over time. And every time, like the first time, I strategically said, I shouldn't chase him. Like if he's got any interest in me, it has to come from him. If I seem too desperate or interested, it won't work out. So I don't chase him. But he gets me every time by saying, I'm going to Europe for 3 weeks. You know, we should talk before I go. So I finally meet him in his office. He offers me a job. I take it. He goes to Europe. When he comes back, his secretary calls me. I come in for a meeting, and he goes, let me see, where were we? We were talking about you working here, right? I'm not sure that this is the right time. So my mind cracks. I walk out, you know, and okay. And I'm still going to see the Heads. I'm still bumping into him. I'm still visiting Lenny, so I'm bumping into him in the office, and this repeats itself like three times. You know, he'll get me to come and see him before he goes to Europe, and when he comes back, somehow it's not a job.
Right.
So the third time this goes on, I go in for the post, you know, U.S. return meeting. I walk in, I go, I know, you changed your mind. He said, what are you talking about? You start Monday.
Awesome.
Nice.
So at that point, I helped, you know, make a deal for Sire with the Heads. You know, Seymour, I had learned more about the fact that they had actually been talking about signing. And that was when the band turned to him and said, look, it's not that we don't want to be with you. We don't want to sign a deal right now. We want to go like write more songs and get better, and we'll talk to you later.
Now, were they close to bands like Blondie and Ramones and Richard Void and all of those bands that were kind of at that same time?
Well, they were all certainly playing the same venues, especially CBGBs. And so they certainly knew each other. And I think over the years, as you know, you've named a number of the bands on that circuit that all ended up with record deals and a reasonable level of success. So over time, I think they maintained their relationship, and they had, you know, more in common than we're just playing the same venue, but we're going nowhere. These were the people that went somewhere.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is, did they choose Sire, or did Sire choose them?
Them being Talking Heads?
Yeah.
I think it was mutual, but they did have other offers by the time we were trying to sign them.
So what knocked it over?
I would say his charming personality and love for the band and belief.
Yeah, especially if you got David to talk.
Well, I got him to wave.
From a distance.
He waved hello from across the crowded room.
How successful was Sire when you had signed the Talking Heads? I mean, did you have anyone that was kind of leading the pack, if you will, or was it still everyone was kind of on a level playing field?
So, understanding that what was paying the bills was all of this regular music, you know, mm-hmm. pre-punk rock music.
Right.
Renaissance was a, you know, fairly successful FM act, mm-hmm. especially up and down the East Coast. They were selling hundreds of thousands of records. Climax Blues Band, I don't know if they were selling that many, but they, again, they were working. They had a big success. Seymour had signed a Dutch band called Focus. A progressive, a progressive rock band who lucked into a top 10 single with Hocus Pocus and sold a lot of albums. That really was working. And then Seymour became aware of the Ramones through Danny Fields, who managed them, and you know, he had his own version of the conversion moment where he signed them, and I don't think there was any competition from other major labels. In fact, there is an infamous letter that Clive Davis wrote to his friend Seymour saying, "The fact that you have recorded and released this Ramones album is an insult to recording artists everywhere." I'm paraphrasing, but I think I have it pretty close.
Wow. And knowing his background, he was probably more of a fan of the Climax Blues Band and the Hamilton Joe Frank and Reynolds. He's like, "Now this is good quality stuff. These are hits."
That would be Clive Davis.
Yeah.
But in Seymour's book, he had stated that you had to make a decision about the Talking Heads. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, about whether or not I would manage them or come to the label?
Yes.
I don't know what you're talking about. No, I'm kidding. That was real. There were conversations about me managing them between me and the band. And I basically realized I could be more useful as the inside man. I think the statute of limitations has run out, so I can admit that. You know, that if I had been the manager, like, who was it that was going to make it happen at the label?
Exactly.
Right.
And
right,
quite frankly,
right.
As we get into this interview, people are going to realize you're instrumental in the Pretenders and Madonna and other bands. So for you to stay with Sire gave us as consumers the opportunity to listen to a lot of these really phenomenal bands that you were a part of. Should we shift over to Pretenders?
Yeah.
Sure, we can do that. Let me make the shift this way.
Okay,
so
perfect.
I decided not to manage them and to stay. I reached out to my friend, Gary Kerr, first, who I thought would be a perfect suggestion. And if he liked the music, he did. And, you know, the rest is history. That was a, he managed the band for his, their entire time together. So there, so I was now at Sire, and, you know, I was happy with that choice until it became clear to me that no matter what we did as Sire, ABC was not capable of breaking these bands. Forget whether they wanted to or not. It just was so far out of their wheelhouse. I think I described it once as a drunken scoutmaster taking a Cub Scout out on a hike, and they're stumbling around in the woods, and it, they realize they're lost, and it's late, and oh my God, what's going to happen? So the little Cub Scout takes a rock and a big rock and a little rock, and he's rubbing them together on top of a dry leaf, and it sparks, the leaf catches fire, and he says, "Look, Scoutmaster, I've got a fire going," and the drunk scoutmaster is taking a leak, and he turns around to see and pisses the fire out. So the drunk scoutmaster, for those of you not paying close attention, would be ABC Records, and the little Cub Scout would be Sire.
That is a great metaphor.
So yeah, no matter what fire we could get going, it just wasn't going to turn into a conflagration with ABC. So I came to a personal decision that I really didn't share with anybody, that knowing, as I did, that the distribution deal with ABC was coming up about 6 months out, I said, I will wait and see. And if we stay with ABC, I'm definitely leaving. And if we sign with somebody else, I'll decide based on who it is. Never dreaming that it was even possible that we would sign with not only the best record company there ever was, but the only major who would really be the right partner to take on this newfangled, crazy kind of music. And yet, miraculously, you know, 6-8 months later, we signed with Warner Brothers. So I obviously stayed, and lots of amazing and wonderful things happened.
Definitely.
And one of them was that I became aware of a record that was on a small label in England, but that a label that was owned by WEA, or, you know, Warner Electro Atlantic, which was the English company that handled all of the music that in America was on three different labels, Warner, Elektra, and Atlantic. They were all on one label in the rest of the world. They were all together. And then the fourth amount of music would be local music that WEA England or WEA France signed. So this single, Stop Your Sobbing, I got a hold of it. I'm listening to it. It's friggin' amazing. And it's on WEA right now. Seymour is best friends with the guy who's the MD of WEA UK. So I go to him and I say, "Here, listen to this." He listens to it. He says, "Man, it's great." You know, I said, "So we should sign this band for America." He said, "Well, it can't happen." I said, "What do you mean? Like, it can't happen. Like, nobody else even knows this record is out. No one in America. Let's just sign them." He said, "Well, it can't happen." I said, "What?" Charles, who's the MD, the head of the English company, he's your best friend. Like, make it happen. Come on, man. He says, "Look, you don't understand how it works at the various WEA companies. Is there's a round robin system where when there is a foreign act that is available for America, like Warner's gets a shot, and if they don't want the act, then Elektra can take it, and if they don't want it, Atlantic can take it, or they all pass, and we keep going. So you know, is if Warner takes the first back, then Elektra is next up. They get the first shot, then Atlantic, then Warner's. And it goes like that. And, so he looks me in the eye and he says, can you tell me that you actually think that Warner, Elektra, and Atlantic are all going to pass on this band? I go, no, there's no way. So that's why we have to go get it now when nobody knows about it. He said, look, that's not how it works. It's not the rule. I said, when did you ever pay attention to the rules?
Right. He said,
look, it can't happen. I said, I'm very young, but you're just trying to give me a heart attack.
He shut you down.
Right. So a few weeks later, he's off on one of his trips to England. And you know, I've been, you know, bugging him, putting thoughts in his head the whole time. And now as he's leaving, I'm saying, you have got to get this band. I'm telling you, it's going to be huge. Like, we need to have this band, not only because they are fantastic, but they will be a battering ram for this new punk style music. He said, well, I don't disagree with you, but there's nothing that can be done. I'm just going, stop saying that and make it happen. Okay, so he goes off to England, and I just remember this is before cell phones. It's before fax machines. We were using telex machines. So kids, you can go Google that. So he's gone, like, for 2 weeks, and I can only, you know, reach him if he's at the office or at the flat. And, you know, I keep trying. I can't reach him. I'm leaving messages everywhere. I'm literally, you know, losing my mind and nothing. No. So finally, my intercom buzzes. They go, it's Seymour on line two. So I pick up and go, hey, you know, hey, how's it going? What's going on? He says, well, Wea wants me to take a meeting with Dave Hill, who is the owner of Real Records, which is the smaller label that the Pretenders are directly signed to. So he says, Wea wants me to take a meeting with Dave Hill. Should I do it? And I'm going, you're just literally messing with me. Of course you should do it and get me this friggin' band. I can break it. Like, come on. Okay, so he goes, and of course, I don't hear from him again for another 2 or 3 days.
Oh, man.
And finally, right? So after I had been resuscitated by the paramedics, he finally calls back, and I said, well, tell me, what happened in the meeting? He says, so I walk in, and I go, you know, Dave, how's it going? He says, and Dave says to him, he says, well, it's all okay, but the truth is, all I really want to do is manage the Pretenders, you know, but I'm committed to the label, and I don't really know what to do. And Seymour says, well, I think I can help you. He said, I'll buy the label, which will give you a little bit of money, and then I'll sign the Pretenders to a fairly substantial deal for North America, and you can commission that, and between the two amounts of money, you should be able to open a management company. So that's what we did.
That's a great story.
Circumvented the WEA round robin, and the rest is rock and roll history.
That is a great
story.
And
for the listeners, this is a great example of the passion that's connected to the music business, because when you hear something before anybody else, and you know in your bones, you know in your intuition that there's something here, and it just lights you up. And what you're explaining is totally what a promotion person goes through on a regular basis when that specific song or that specific band makes a connection.
You really went to bat for the Pretenders, obviously. I mean, and they had the talent. But is it safe to say, had you not pushed as hard as you did, would we have a Pretenders today? Not to saying you're solely responsible for their success, but it seems like you kind of are.
Obviously, we short of going back in time and doing it another way, we wouldn't really know. But I think that there is a yes answer and a no answer. The yes answer to me is that, you know, unlike some of the other even talking heads, like the Pretenders were, they had something special, but it was a little more mainstream than the Ramones or the Heads.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe it's fair to say that some other label could have wrapped their mind around what the Pretenders were up to more easily than they could have wrapped their mind around what the Ramones were up to in the beginning, or certainly what the trio talking head, like, it just would have been easier for someone else to get it and go for it. I will say, that, on the other hand, that by signing to Sire, where I'll take a little bow, like where I was sort of picking the priorities, like what are we really going to put our efforts and our money into breaking?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that ensured that it happened at Sire. You know, once they were at Sire, that ensured it. And obviously, Sire had incredible successes. Seymour had an amazing ear and signed a lot of great stuff. And we did well with some of it, and some of it that was fantastic, we couldn't break for any number of reasons. But this was one that I think was destined to happen no matter what. And that's really why I was so desperate.
You could feel it.
We've got to get them before somebody else takes them, because they will. There were other bands where I'm not even sure somebody would have signed them, let alone broken them. But this one I knew. I think once upon a time I snarkily said that they were Fleetwood Mac in the Ramones clothes.
Well, so for me, Kenny, Sire created their distribution with Warner Brothers in the fall of 77, and I started March 6th of 1978, and then I got a reputation of playing or getting the start on a lot of Sire product. But that one debut album, there's a few albums in my career that I can honestly say I was the one that started them. And it was the Pretenders debut album that I can say with confidence that I really broke in my region. But when you listen to that debut album today, it's damn near a greatest hits album. I mean, you've got Brass in Pocket, mm-hmm. you've got Precious, mm-hmm. you've got Stop Your Sobbing, Tattooed Love Boys, Kid. I mean, mm-hmm. just phenomenal songs, each and every one of them. And there was something pretty magical about that band. No question about it. And I think to answer your question, Lloyd, I think the power of the Warner Brothers, I mean, first of all, we had more reps than any other label.
Right.
So I think we had 23 locals. So I think the power of the song, I think the power of the band, and I think the power of the staff all came together, because when you look back, were they really a punk band? No, they're a brilliant rock and roll band.
Did you hear what he said? Mm-hmm. He said he called them Fleetwood Mac in Ramones clothing.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
That is so right on the spot.
All right, so there's this notorious story about this girl named Madonna.
Wow, here we go.
And, you know, not everyone has heard how she got signed and the backstory. So spring it on us, big guy.
Tell us
about this one.
Well, to give credit where it is due, and there's plenty of credit to go around, but originally the demo was brought in by a guy named Michael Rosenblatt, who has gone on to have many successes in his career. And he was at Sire, he was doing A&R listening, right? He was just listening to incoming tapes for Seymour. And I was the executive vice president of marketing and promotion. And so basically I took over after the records were pressed, right? That was my area of responsibility. And Michael worked for me kind of half the time working on how do we get these things sold and broken and exposed. And he worked half the time for Seymour, like listening, like, hey, would this be good? That would be good. Okay. So he came up with the demo and he brought it to me. And it was a song and we both fell in love with it. And it there was something magical about it.
And, what song is that? Tell us what song that was.
It's a song that was never released.
Really?
Because we loved this song. So I'm gonna jump ahead. So she does get signed, and we start to make the first album. And Michael and I are saying, "You got to do this song." It was called "Ain't No Big Deal," and so they cut it. You know, and she worked with a number of producers over the first three albums, and we kept pressuring, "You gotta cut that song." So it didn't make the first album, it didn't make the second album, it didn't make the third album. And it was one of those things where the demo just had a magic about it, but it was recorded in such a way that you couldn't take the demo tapes and build on them.
Okay.
Right? It just was too technologically funky, right? And I don't mean funky like a drummer. I mean, funky like bad cheese.
Right.
So it wasn't able, you had to start over. And somehow they never caught the magic again. And at a certain point, she was big enough that she told us to shut up and stop pressuring her about that crazy old song.
Is it available anywhere? I mean, I guess maybe you still have a copy of it, but I mean, is it available out there like in the internet world we live in?
Well, I was just going to say, I don't know that it is, but nothing would surprise me if, you know, I think everything that's ever existed in the world is hiding somewhere
right
on the internet.
Okay, so that's fair.
Anyway, back to, you know, I love the thing. It's great. I tell Michael, go play it for Seymour. He loves it. He loves her. So we... The original recordings were made under the auspices of, and I am blanking on Mark's last name, but he was the DJ at Hurrah, which was the preeminent new wave discotheque. And so, you know, we get to a point where we're saying, you know, like I think we should meet him and, like, you know, talk about doing a deal. And as much as I love the song and everything, I really felt that Michael deserved a signing because he had been working, you know, for the label for long enough. And I wanted to see him get a signing, you know. And it sounds funny now knowing who she is, but, you know, I'm not claiming that I thought it was going to be the biggest act of the next 10 years. I'm just saying I thought it was a great act, and I thought Michael deserved to get a shot with signing someone up and getting a record out, and let's see what we can do.
Right.
So Seymour is in the hospital, and he's doing okay, but he can't get out in time, so it's decided that Mark is going to come for the meeting at the hospital. So
Seymour's in his hospital bed.
Right. Well, so I go to the hospital, you know, an hour or so before the meeting. I get there and he's been in the hospital. If you know anything about being in the hospital, you're not like bathing every day. You're, you know, you haven't shaved, whatever. So I said, Seymour, Mark's is going to be here. You got to go take a shower. And, so anyway, he goes to take a shower and the rest is history. He came out clean. Mark came and
brought Madonna with him.
Not at that first meeting.
Oh, okay.
Can you imagine been there, though? How funny that would have been.
There was a follow-up meeting, of course, and many after that. And, you know, like they say, the rest is history. It was, you know, she was unstoppable.
Give me one of the best qualities and worst qualities of Madonna at the beginning of her career.
I will say this, which will cover everything. success didn't change her.
Hmm.
She was a force of nature when she didn't have two nickels to rub together.
Wow.
And she's still a force of nature. So to close our show with you, what band that you had intimate relationship with, you know, like the Heads or Madonna or all the other bands, Pretenders, which one would you say is like your one of the ones that you enjoyed the most?
You know, they're like your children.
Yeah.
Hard to pick.
Got
one.
It.
Right.
Especially because in my case, you know, in America, there really is a wall between A&R, you know, basically what I call the finding process, and marketing and promotion, which is the foisting process, right? Get them out there. And I was lucky in the sense that working at a smallish label like Sire, even though my job or my responsibility was over on the foisting side, I did have the ability to impact certain things, that whether they would be signed or not. So especially in the case of the Heads and the Pretenders, where I did have input to the signing, and Madonna to some degree as well, then I got to work on them. I got to make sure that they got launched out of the gate, that they made their way, that they had every chance to be discovered by the public and appreciated. So especially because of that, because it wasn't just like, okay, I signed them and now I'm turning it over to the promotion and marketing people. So I actually got to work on them. It really is hard to pick.
What a great gig, though. You got the best of both worlds. And I have to say, man, that's a powerful position to be in, because you can make sure that the bands you're passionate about are getting noticed and getting
exactly.
heard. I mean, that's a great place to be in.
Exactly.
Lloyd, it's funny that you say that, because in the UK, the A&R guy is responsible for shepherding the act through marketing and promotion. And I always thought, that, you know, here's the person who's the most passionate. Here's the person that understood it first. Like, of course you would want them to be at least, you know, kind of like what in America became known as a product manager. But again, a product manager kind of shepherds the release of the record through the system. In England, it's the same guy doing the shepherding that did the signing. Now, I was lucky enough for the magic time when Sire was a joint venture with Warner Brothers to be able to do both. But, you know, that was not the typical American system.
And, you know, one of the things about the Talking Heads in particular is their growth. I mean, they went from a trio when you saw them. They brought in Jerry Harrison. Then they started to just continually grow in so many amazing directions that before you know it, they bring in Bernie Worrell and they bring in other members to fill mm-hmm. out the sound. And it became a really interesting, era for them. And then, of course, Chris and Tina spin off Tom Tom Club,
yeah,
which was a really great mm-hmm. Adventure for them. That was a lot of fun.
It just proves what I think everybody kind of already knows, that they were three and then four, really incredibly artistic people, and that given the right palette, they were going to run with it, and we're all the better for it.
I guess before we close out, I have one final question, and what is your relationship with some of these artists who have gone on to have, you know, great success? What's your connection today, being at where you're at in your age today?
I'm still very close with Chris and Tina. I see Jerry every now and then. We live on opposite coasts. I know David a little bit. I haven't seen, unfortunately, a bunch of the Pretenders are no longer with us. Every once in a while when I'm in England, I see Martin. And
what a great drummer.
Kind of like that.
Yeah.
Kind of like that.
How about Madonna? Do you ever talk to her ever again?
I did over the years, but I have not been in contact with her.
Gotcha.
In quite a while.
I would expect at least a fruitcake or something in the mail at Christmas time. Good God.
Yeah. That's funny.
I didn't say that. You did.
Kenny,
but
thank you.
Geez.
Thank you for joining us today. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, guys. I love the show, so I'm happy to be on it.
Should we call this podcast Madonna Throw Me a Bone?
Or a fruitcake?
Or a fruitcake.
There you go.
Or a Ferrari.
I owe you one fruitcake.
There you go. There you go.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank
it's been
so
a blast.
Much. Man, I've enjoyed it.
No, thank you guys for doing what you're doing. It really is fun.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.